the war on the ground in Ukraine continues to shift, what is clear, Russia is focused on capturing the east of Ukraine.
Beyond that, it's not clear what Russian war aims will be. They may look to pause the conflict, or they may try to declare a victory.
Plus, the Pope makes a big apology for abuses committed toward Indigenous children in Canada. Words matter, but
I really wanted to hear something that I could take back to my community and to my people to say that there's going to be action done.
And Eastern Australia is flooding again, renewing calls to change the way people live in flood-prone areas. Small things, like ditching the carpet.
If we had a polished concrete floor and just rugs, you can take them away when water is coming. Those little things can really make an enormous difference.
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. For the first time in the war in Ukraine, Russia claims its territory has been attacked. A regional Russian governor is saying that Ukrainian helicopters crossed into Russian territory and fired on an oil depot in the Russian city of Belgorod. Ukraine's foreign minister said he could neither confirm nor reject the claim. Meanwhile, Russian forces continue to strike at targets in Ukraine's north and around the capital, Kyiv. For the latest on the ground, we're joined now by Michael Kaufman, the director of the Russia Studies Program at the Center for Naval Analysis. Michael, there's footage of the Russian oil storage facility up in flames, but we still don't have details about the attack, nor has it been confirmed. What's the significance of this?
I think it is significant that Ukraine was able to conduct a strike in Russian territory proper. It appears to have been a helicopter raid by at least a pair of Ukrainian Mi-24 helicopters, and they destroyed a substantial amount of oil from the looks of it. There are a lot of videos that confirm that this attack took place. Now, it's not the first Ukrainian attack onto Russian territory. Early on in the war, Ukraine conducted a strike with a ballistic missile against a Russian air base in the first couple days of the war.
Now, I want to move to a wider view on where this war stands. Is Russia changing its strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. Initially, the Russian strategy was deeply flawed. It was a diffused military effort. They were going after many different objectives, spreading their forces. Now, it seems they've focused and they've announced that they're going to primarily pursue trying to capture all the Donbass, and this includes also the siege of Mariupol. Beyond that, it's not clear what Russian war aims will be. They may look to pause the conflict, or they may try to declare a victory and suggest that the entire war was really all about these territories, which quite clearly it wasn't. But that looks to be the focus of their efforts.
And the Donbass, of course, is in eastern Ukraine, and the whole siege of Mariupol has been to create that land bridge to Crimea. How would you assess Russia's military performance overall thus far?
I think it's quite poor. It's clear that Russian performance is far outside that which was earlier expected. The Russian military was first sent in to conduct quick regime change, not really prepared or organized for a real war. The troops psychologically weren't prepared for it either. They suffered substantial casualties, lost considerable amounts of equipment. But of course, it's really not clear where we are in this conflict. It may be safe to say that the first chapter of the war is closed, but it's not clear how much longer this war can go on. And wars often don't end how they begin.
What do you mean by that, in terms of you're not sure how long this war can go on?
Well, this could transition to a sustained war of attrition. And while Ukraine is winning politically, and Ukraine right now is doing very well on the battlefield, I think if we overestimated the likely performance of the Russian military, the null of significant stories, we dramatically underestimated Ukrainian military performance. But that said, we're barely 5 weeks, maybe a bit more, into a conflict between two major states in Europe.
One thing that's interesting is Western officials are saying that Russia's military lacks a battlefield commander. Is that the case?
What they mean by that is there's not a clear single commander for this war in the Russian military. And in fact, the Russian military suffered tremendously from poor coordination in terms of how its command and control is organized. There are four different Russian military districts involved in this war, some running more than one axis of advance, and they don't seem to be coordinating their efforts all that well. It seems a lot of the integrations in Moscow, which is leading to a lot of problems in terms of adaptation and Russian reaction time. It's clear they just can't scale towards executing large military operations of this type effectively, and they've never tried anything like this in decades.
Ukraine's President Zelensky has said that he's relying on his military to conduct the war, that he's not making those decisions. He has good people to do that. Is that the case with Vladimir Putin, or is he directing the war from Moscow?
I think that's likely the case as well with Vladimir Putin, but it's clear they've made significant adjustments in terms of the war aims. Putin, at the end of the day, sets the war aims. And the Russian military, in the first couple of weeks, was clearly trying to achieve unworkable political objectives. In that regard, I think they threw a lot of manpower and equipment, frankly, away in the sense that they were attempting to reach objectives that they just couldn't possibly reach with the forces they had available. Right? And that actually took Moscow a very long time, at least from my point of view, to revise its war aims once it was clear that they couldn't attain regime change within a few days and start to pursue something that could remotely be attainable by the military power they had.
Western officials are also saying that Putin is being misinformed about the war effort. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, how would I know what Putin's being informed or not informed of?
But it's interesting, Western officials are saying that they feel like Putin's not getting the right information about what's really going on in the battlefield.
So my view of it is that it's not clear if he understands the realities on the ground. And there's often a divergence because the military may not be willing to admit the losses they've had and the likelihood that they can attain his political objectives, on the one hand. On the other hand, it is also quite possible that they have told this to him, but he refuses to listen and hear. Political leaders will overrule sound military advice. They do this all the time, not just in personalist authoritarian systems. I've definitely seen it in democracies. So the truth is, it's very likely there's a delta between the objective reality is and Vladimir Putin's perception of it.
Syria is also sending hundreds of soldiers to fight with Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm not surprised, but I don't think they're going to get much out of Syrian fighters in terms of manpower, and they're not going to make any substantive difference on this battlefield. I don't think it's going to be that significant. What difference would a battalion or a company of Syrians make in a war where 200,000 Russian troops are now doing well?
Finally, I want to ask you about the peace talks. They're ongoing, of course. Judging by what you've been observing, is there an off-ramp here, a potential diplomatic solution?
Well, most wars end with diplomatic solutions and political settlements. It's just not clear that the talks currently taking place are happening in earnest or that there's any diplomatic solution on the horizon right now. It may be far too early in the conflict for either side to contemplate any serious concessions or compromises.
Michael Kaufman is the director of the Russia Studies Program at the Center for Naval Analysis. He's been talking with us about Russia's war against Ukraine. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on your program.
Now back to a story we reported on yesterday, Somalia's ongoing drought. Extreme conditions scientists are predicting will only get worse with climate change. More than 500,000 people in Somalia have left their homes because of the latest drought. The World's Halima Gakandi reports from the district of Galkayo in Somalia.
On the way to Kurasan village, camels trudge slowly on the roadside, searching for food and water. The landscape is pretty bleak. All the shrubs and trees are mostly dried out. It hasn't always been like this, says Shafi Abdi Chama. He's the deputy chairman of the village. During the rainy season, this area usually becomes very green, Abdi Chama says. The problem is, over the past 2 years or so, there's hardly been any rain at all. Abdi Chama tells me that during the rainy season, people here normally collect and store rainwater in underground reserves. But because the current drought has gone on for so long, even the water storage has run dry. Help occasionally comes from NGOs that bring in water by truck. Women hurry to fill their jerry cans. Abdi Chama tells me people prioritize what little water they get for drinking, cooking, and cleaning. Then what's left goes to surviving livestock. But he says two-thirds of his animals have died off. People are leaving this village because of the drought, he says. Around 20% of the population has left for nearby towns or camps for internally displaced people. At one nearby camp, I meet Fatima Ahmed, who arrived about 2 weeks ago. She left her home after her animals, a source of food and income, all died.
Then
We only eat once a day, in the morning, she tells me, whatever God gives us, maybe some tea, porridge, or bread. I ask her if the rains do come this month and the drought ends, will she go back home to pick up her life as a herder? I'll stay here if I can get help, she tells me, because there's nothing left for me back home. This mass displacement and relocation is only one of the profound ways this drought is changing life in Somalia. Adam Abdelmoula is a top UN official here. He says the problem isn't this drought alone. It's intensifying climate change. I meet him at his office in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu.
What makes the current wave of drought different is its intensity. Over the past 20 years, the rate of droughts and floods in Somalia has increased threefold.
Experts say environmental degradation is part of the problem. Somalia has lost an estimated 20% of its forests in the past 20 years. Temperatures in Somalia and the Horn of Africa region are also expected to warm faster. That could make part of this region uninhabitable.
There is talk that if the global temperatures exceed 1.5 degrees, then climate change becomes irreversible. For me, it is already irreversible in places like Somalia.
Abdelmoula says the international community needs to take this more seriously, but he's been seeing a lot of donor fatigue when it comes to Somalia. For decades, the country has grappled with political instability and terrorism, and that's made addressing humanitarian problems more difficult.
They are investing in other places, and Somalia has been pushed to the back burner. And I keep saying that the world ignores Somalia at its own peril, because when that happened in the past, we have seen the rise of terrorism, piracy, mass migration, mass disease and starvation.
Abdelmoula says much more aid money is needed to avert a famine in Somalia, but in the long run, humanitarian aid is not enough.
All that we keep doing is scale up humanitarian interventions that are just putting a band-aid on a disease that needs a more radical cure. And that cure is heavy investment in climate adaptation.
Climate adaptation, so people can manage the changing environment and these more frequent droughts. Abdelmoula gives examples of skill building for pastoralists and farmers who are moving to cities. Back at the village in Galkayo, 28-year-old herder Burhan Abdichana is grappling with questions about his future. He stands in front of his last remaining goats and sheep. Before the drought, I had 400 animals, he says. Now, they're about 35. So I ask, is he planning to leave the village, like the others? I'm stressed about what to do next, he tells me. Raising animals is all I know how to do. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Galkayo, Somalia.
It's not happening until November, but today, soccer fans found out who's playing whom in the 2022 World Cup.
Your hosts for tonight's show, Idris Elba and Reshman Chowdhury.
After nearly 45 minutes of pomp and ceremony in Doha, the capital of host country Qatar, the ritual began and the names were drawn.
So the United States of America will be going into Group B with England, JJ.
32 teams divided into eight groups, an exciting moment, but not so exciting for fans of Team Egypt. We'll have more on their story, heartbreak, and allegations of racism among African soccer fans next week. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The Darien Gap is a dense jungle area that separates South and Central America. It sits between Colombia and Panama and is a notoriously dangerous route for migrants. The number of people passing through the Darien Gap in recent months had gone down, but in recent weeks, a rising number of people from Venezuela have been making the risky crossing. The World's Tipisay Seya reports.
Jose Loya says he can't believe he's still alive.
Yo todavía no puedo creer estar contándote esto y haber sobrevivido, ¿no? A esa travesía.
Loya is from Venezuela and just arrived in the United States last week after a two-month journey through 10 countries in South and Central America. He speaks with me from West Virginia, where he's staying with a friend. When I ask Loya about passing through the Darien Gap, he He tells me the best way to describe it is like a green hell.
Donde te consigues son subidas empinadas, caminos de lodo, ríos caudalosos.
You have to climb steep hills, he says, and trudge through swamps. We walk 12 hours a day. We saw dead bodies. We came across a 2-year-old child who was abandoned. Loya tells me this is not easy for him to talk about. He saw the worst side of human beings, he says.
Conocer de cerca la parte inhumana.
This is from a video that Loya shot in the Darien Gap. It shows people crawling in their hands and knees up a muddy hill. 2,500 Venezuelans crossed the Darien Gap in January and February, according to Panama's government. That's almost the same number of Venezuelans who crossed in all of 2021. Most are heading to the United States, according to Sibija Brodzinski. She's a spokeswoman for the UN High Commission for Refugees. And she says many Venezuelans were flying into Mexico before January when the Mexican authorities started requiring visas.
The new visa requirements, what it does is drives people to dangerous new routes. It doesn't eliminate their need to find stability elsewhere. It just makes it more dangerous.
Brodzinski says about half of the Venezuelans who crossed the Darien Gap in 2022 were previously settled in other countries in South America.
Pandemic-related restrictions affected the informal economy the most. And refugees and migrants in South America generally work in the informal economy. So with the pandemic, not only did their needs increase, but the needs of the families that they support back at home.
Jose Loya, the man in West Virginia, was living in Peru, but he says it was difficult to make ends meet.
Allá te discriminan por tu habla, por tus estudios, por el país de donde vienes.
He says he and his wife and daughter were also facing discrimination. They didn't feel like there was a future for them in Peru, so in January he decided to make the trip by land. It took him a week to get through the Darien Gap. Brodzinski says the area is controlled by criminal gangs.
They pretty consistently rob refugees and migrants. You know, we've seen a number of incidents of sexual assault. At least 50 people were reported killed in the crossing last year. There may be many more that were not reported.
For Loya, getting through the jungle was not the only difficult part of the journey.
Los coyotes que me agarraron en Guatemala
He says he was kidnapped near the border between Guatemala and Honduras, and his family had to send $400 in ransom. In the north of Mexico, Loya says he swam across the Rio Grande and made it safely into the U.S. Now he's applying for asylum in the U.S. and trying to figure out how to bring his wife and 5-year-old daughter. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea.
To better understand why so many Venezuelans are crossing the Darien Gap, reporter Manuel Rueda joins us from Bogota. Manuel, what's the situation in Venezuela right now?
Well, in Venezuela, the economy contracted for 7 years in a row, and the country had the worst inflation in the world. That stopped a little bit. The economy actually recovered slightly last year with a 4% increase. But what you have in Venezuela is still the lowest wages in South America. In Venezuela, the minimum wage is currently about $30 a month. Now, if somebody from Venezuela crosses into Colombia, for example, and gets a job at a construction site, they're going to get paid $200 a month. So those economic disparities give people a big reason to migrate.
I know Venezuelans have been leaving their country for a number of years now. How many are we talking about at this point?
So overall, the United Nations says that 6 million people have left the country since 2015.
Gosh.
Out of those 6 million people, 4 million have gone to Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, and Chile. So those are the countries that are taking most of the Venezuelan refugees and migrants.
How has this massive movement of Venezuelans to other countries in South America affected the region as a whole?
Well, what you've seen is that countries initially struggle with their education and healthcare systems, because, you know, especially in some border areas, they're receiving a massive influx of people. For example, in the Colombian border, the United Nations has even helped local governments to make schools bigger, you know, just to physically make like more infrastructure for more kids to fit in the school. Initially, it's a shock on healthcare and on education, particularly. In the long run, however, you know, what people are hoping is that these new migrants integrate into the economy. One characteristic about Venezuelan migrants is that they're usually younger than the average age of the people in the countries they get into. So it gives these countries somewhat of a demographic bonus that can be helpful.
For Venezuelans who decide to remain permanently in Colombia, what's the situation like for them?
Well, the situation has been getting harder since the pandemic started because unemployment has skyrocketed in Colombia in 2020 with the pandemic. Now it's stabilizing somewhat. But it's not just in Colombia. It's in Peru and in Ecuador as well. You know, it's just harder to get work. And some people are getting frustrated with that and are looking for other destinations, which is why you have people like the gentleman in the story who went from Peru to the United States.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I mean, you mentioned Peru, and I know many Venezuelans are going there and to Chile. How are those countries handling the situation?
Well, what we've seen is more restrictions on Venezuelans traveling to other countries in Latin America. So places, for example, like Ecuador and Peru started asking for visas in 2019, Panama as well, and Chile on their border with Bolivia. They've built a ditch about 2 kilometers long, trying to make it harder for the migrants to get into the country illegally.
Sounds like a moat.
Yes, a moat, exactly. Like a big trench surrounded purely by desert. But this is like the border crossing point, you know, the most common route to get overland into Chile. So they've built that there to slow down illegal immigration.
Manuel Rueda is a reporter based in Bogota, Colombia. Manuel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Pope's mea culpa. You're listening to The World. The holy month of Ramadan means fasting by day and breaking that fast each night. The evening meal is meant to be a celebration, but in Lebanon, food prices have increased by 1,000%.
Every time we think we have been through the worst in Lebanon, another catastrophe knocks our door.
Now aid groups across the Middle East are gearing up to help families bring food to the table this Ramadan. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Just after noon today, Vatican time, Pope Francis addressed people from Canada's 3 largest indigenous groups.
I ask for God's forgiveness, and I want to say to you with all my heart, I am very sorry.
The papal apology was for abuses by the Catholic Church that went on for more than a century. Pope Francis spoke of the shame and indignation he felt for the suffering of Indigenous children who were forced to leave their families and attend residential schools across Canada. The Pope's apology came at the end of a week of meetings between Vatican officials and representatives from Canada's Indigenous populations. Gajajuni Fox of the Mohawk Nation traveled to the Vatican with the delegates and attended today's ceremony. Gajajuni, Canada's Indigenous families have been pressing the Catholic Church on this for years. What's been their reaction to today's ceremony?
I think for, you know, some of the delegates that were there, I don't really want to speak on behalf of them, but like being in the space, some of the people that were there, the delegates, you could tell were happy about the news of the apology. And then others, I think, like myself, wanted more. I really wanted to hear something that I could take back to my community and to my people to say that there's going to be action done.
What specific actions would you like the Catholic Church to take?
Well, one of the things that they had promised was to give the Indigenous people of Canada $25 million to help with healing. They said they were going to raise those funds, and they haven't delivered on that yet.
Gajajuni, was your own family affected by these residential schools?
My dad went to school in Spanish, one of the boarding schools out there, and still to this day doesn't tell what happened to him there. They're ashamed to even talk about it. Some of the, you know, the assaults, the sexual assaults, the physical abuse, the things that happened while they're in residential school. And on my mom's side, my great-grandfather was at Carlisle Indian School. And he was taken when he was 5 years old and didn't come back till he was 20. He survived and he came back. But because he had been in an institution where he didn't have the love of his mom and he didn't have the support of his family, he didn't know how to give that to his family.
I know members of your delegation presented the Pope with gifts today. There were prayers and music, too. Can you describe that?
There was gifts from, there was the Inuit, the Métis, and then the First Nations group all presented gifts.
You yourself brought something for the Pope. What was it?
We brought a cradle board that was made by a young man from our community. And cradle boards are what we carry our babies in, kind of like they're in the womb of their mom because they're wrapped up in that board. So what we brought to leave overnight with the Pope was an empty cradle board to symbolize all of our young ones that went to residential school and were not able to come home because they passed away.
Gunter Juni, what will you carry away from this day?
I think, like, for myself personally, the people that I met, to hear them speak and to speak with such passion and to speak on behalf of those ones that didn't make it and to ask for action. So that's what I'm taking home with me.
Gunter Juni Fox is an artist and filmmaker from Akwesasne, Mohawk Nation territory that straddles the St. Lawrence River along the Canadian and U.S. border. She's been telling us about the ceremony at the Vatican today, where Pope Francis apologized formally for the Catholic Church's role in more than a century of abuses at Canada's residential schools. Thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
For the past 2 years, the Muslim holy month of Ramadan has been upended by the pandemic. Families were warned not to gather in large groups for iftar, the nightly meal that breaks the daily fast. This year, COVID is not as big of a worry, but food prices across the Middle East and North Africa have skyrocketed, adding a different challenge to the celebrations. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Nadia Rayan is a mother of five who lives in Jordan's capital city, Amman.
I love cooking. I think it's a work of art.
Rayan plans to cook 20 meals during Ramadan, including traditional dishes like mansaf, fattoush, tabbouleh, and kataif. Earlier this week, she went to the store to get the shopping done in one fell swoop. She noticed higher prices on fruits and vegetables, but says it's worth it and bought them anyway.
It's our tradition in Ramadan to gather and be together, feel the family.
And she thinks other households will do the same.
Whether they have enough money or not, they will buy things for Ramadan because it's a special month for us.
But in Lebanon, Maya Taro knows not everyone will be able to make that happen. 10 years ago, she started a nonprofit called Food Blessed in Beirut. They hand out food to anyone who needs it across the country. And demand has continued to climb.
Every time we think we have been through the worst in Lebanon, another catastrophe knocks our door. If you ask any family what's your number one worry, they'll not tell you finding a job. It'll be like, how do I put food on my table?
Typically, Taro says her organization supports 1,600 families each month. During Ramadan, that bumps up to 2,400. Still, with the UN estimating that almost 80% of Lebanon's population lives in poverty, supply is nowhere close to meeting demand. Taro says one day earlier this week, Food Blessed got 11,000 WhatsApp messages from people in need.
And the majority of them have never imagined having to ask for help from charities. So there is no longer a middle class.
There are a number of reasons why this is such an issue in Lebanon specifically. The country has faced an economic meltdown since 2019. Food prices are now 11 times higher than before the crisis, according to the World Food Program. And the lira has lost more than 90% of its value, keeping everyday goods out of reach, even during Ramadan, when people gather around the nightly meal, iftar.
Even that one meal per day that they fast the whole day to enjoy, some families will not be able to enjoy it. A lot of families are already removing dairy and meat and poultry from their diets. It's not manageable.
Other factors are impacting prices throughout the entire region, which relies heavily on food imports, says Nader Habibi, a professor of economics of the Middle East at Brandeis University.
The climate and the quality of land does not allow for enough internal production.
That has been an issue for years. Plus, prices usually go up around Ramadan because suppliers know demand is high and they can make some extra cash. But adding to the mess now is what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, two countries that supply more than 25% of the world's wheat.
The exports from Russia and Ukraine have been disrupted, and that has affected food prices everywhere.
For example, local reports in Egypt say the price of bread has increased by 50% since the invasion. And in Jordan, Ramadan staples are reportedly more expensive than ever. A jug of cooking oil has gone up 33% in the past month, while a bag of rice rose in price by 25%. Back in Beirut, Maya Taro says she'll try to get as much food into as many hands as possible for Ramadan, but she hopes just being with family will help.
Maybe some families won't have the food that they want on their tables, but at least they'll get to enjoy their families and friends around them. And I think that's what's going to make all the difference.
The month of Ramadan begins this weekend with the sighting of the crescent moon. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This week, severe floods hit Australia's east coast again. For the second time in a month, heavy rains caused rivers to overflow, forcing thousands of people to head for higher ground. In Byron Bay, a popular surf spot south of Brisbane, the business district is completely submerged. Margaret Cook isn't far from there right now. She's an historian and author of the book, A River with a City Problem, A History of Brisbane Floods. Margaret, how much danger have these latest floods caused?
The damage is horrific. The damage in Brisbane, where I am located, is worse than any other flood we've had. And the floods that are currently going through northern New South Wales, in particular Lismore and Ballina, which are just over the border, those floods are 2 metres higher than any other record we've ever had.
So you're actually specifically in Ipswich, which is a little bit west and inland from Brisbane. The floods, I know, are centered to your south, but you say there's flooding where you are too.
Yeah, we actually had flooding in about a quarter of the east coast of Australia in the last 2 months. And I'm in Ipswich, as I said, which is on the Bremer River, a tributary of the Brisbane River. So when Brisbane floods, we often flood.
You're a flood historian, so help us understand how historic is the flooding that's happening right now.
The floods that we're getting in Lismore are significantly higher, but the Brisbane floods were lower. We can tell from the geological record that there have been much higher floods, and the Aboriginal stories tell us of higher floods. In the 1890s, we had floods in Brisbane that reached 26 feet, which is a phenomenal amount of rain and a phenomenal height for a flood. The floods that we've had recently are half that, but they're still substantial and have flooded over 10,000 homes.
Are floods getting better or worse in the past, say, 50, 75 years?
Floods are getting worse. And with global warming, they're looking that they will continue to get worse because the atmosphere can just hold a lot more water. What's happening is Australian soils are drying out and our weather is getting hotter. So we may get more frequent floods. And the prediction is that we'll get more severe floods.
Now, the title of your book is A River with a City Problem. It begs the question, why was Brisbane built where it was in the first place? Or maybe more specifically, why is it still there?
They're great questions. And part of that is because we were colonized by the British, and the British are maritime people. When you're looking for a city to develop, you find a good port. And Brisbane River is a fabulous port. So Brisbane was settled there because the water supply was useful. The banks of the river provided the timber to build our houses, and we could use the river for fuel. So all of those reasons seemed very sound. And if you don't look at floods, they probably do make a lot of sense. As you ask, why are we still there? Well, because it's a beautiful place to live. A lot of people want to live near a river, and we've got that legacy of history. What I'm always concerned about is there's always legacy issues, but we need to sometimes stop making them worse. So history can give us some of those lessons.
So given Brisbane's history with floods, has it improved the way that it responds to floods over the years?
We're slowly learning, thankfully. Sometimes we're compounding the problem because we're building houses in areas that we shouldn't be building in. And we're not necessarily thinking so much about the design of houses as we should be. But since the last lot of floods, we are getting a little wiser and we've started thinking about how we're building our homes. Traditional houses in Queensland were raised so that water could flow underneath. We used to use hardwoods and things that didn't deteriorate so much in floods, but we've started using modern building materials that just soak in the water and have to be ripped out. Things like carpets are really bad in flood. If we had a polished concrete floor and just rugs, you can take them away when water is coming. So if we start thinking about things like that, those little things can really make an enormous difference for us being able to get back into our houses after a flood.
Margaret, have you been personally affected by these current floods?
Yes, I have. You would think a flood historian wouldn't get flooded, and I didn't from rivers and I didn't from creeks, but the rain was so intense. I actually got 20 inches of rain in 2 days. So the rain actually started to run down the inside of my chimney in my living room. And I also got a lot of overland flow. So I have a very large tank to absorb the water so we can use in drought. And it overflowed, and so it ran underneath my house as well. So I suddenly had the outside drains pouring water into our land, and the council stormwater drains were cascading over the gutters. The water just couldn't get away, basically.
Even flood historians can't escape the floods.
No, I can't. I did my best, but sometimes nature wins.
Margaret Cook is a history lecturer at University of the Sunshine Coast and author of the book, A River with a City Problem, A History of Brisbane Floods. Margaret, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Sri Lanka is an island nation off the southern coast of India that relies heavily on tourism. But these days, the country is experiencing its worst economic crisis in memory. Crowds of protesters gathered outside the presidential palace in the capital, Colombo, yesterday. People stormed police barricades and lit a bus on fire. In response, police fired tear gas and stun grenades to push back the crowds. Ruki Fernando is a human rights activist in Colombo. Ruki, describe what you witnessed at those protests outside the presidential palace.
So this was a kind of expression of desperation, expression of anger, disappointment of many people from all walks of life, who have been protesting for a very long time in different parts of Sri Lanka, in different parts of the Colombo city. And this was like, the second time that there was a major march on the president's house itself.
So were protesters outside the president's house, were they kind of yelling and throwing things? I mean, what were they doing?
I think there's a big demand for the president to go home, to resign. And I think that was the major theme, and they were yelling. The protesters were largely peaceful. So it's a bit difficult to imagine who actually did the burning of the bus, for example. There has been lots of images and videos on social media indicating that there is only one person who actually set the bus alight. And there are a lot of policemen watching that person setting the bus alight. So there is deep-rooted suspicion that this setting the bus on fire was done on purpose.
What exactly is the source of the anger of the protesters?
One is the shortage of fuel, diesel and petrol for vehicles. There's been very, very long lines for more than a month, a severe shortage. And also the prices have been increased dramatically. At the same time, there's also been a massive electricity shortage. We've been having power cuts up to like 13 hours a day. So that makes it impossible for life to go on. Then there's also a shortage of gas. Now, gas is something that many people, particularly in urban settings, use for cooking. And then fourthly, there's also food shortages and dramatic increase in price of food, for example, of lentils and milk food, etc. So basically, it's a very major economic crisis with a lot of shortages of absolutely essential goods and services.
Absolutely. I mean, these are just essential things to daily life in Sri Lanka. What has caused these problems? What's caused the higher prices for fuel and the fact that there's these power outages? What's going on?
I feel that the government in power haven't come up with adequate policies and practices that will ensure that people have adequate fuel, adequate gas, adequate food in particular. Sri Lanka is also a very country rich in kind of biodiversity. We have all kinds of things growing. So there's no necessity for us to starve ourselves and go without food. But it needs a very good system of management, which is what we expect from a government, to ensure that there's a good production, that the producers get a good price and the producers don't get frustrated, consumers get what they need, and also that there's a good distribution system. So, and this has not happened under this government in particular, but also under previous governments.
Ruki Fernando is a human rights activist in Colombo, the capital of Sri Lanka, where he spoke to us from. Thank you, Ruki.
Thank you.
The mural has a long history in Mexico. Thousands of years ago, the Olmecs in southern Mexico painted the walls of caves. Later, the Spanish used colorful wall paintings to dramatize Bible stories. But the most famous murals went up in the 1920s. Think Diego Rivera. The Mexican government paid artists like Rivera to paint historical murals to educate the population, many of whom at the time were illiterate. Themes celebrated indigenous and working-class Mexican culture. The idea was to create a shared sense of identity in a country with so many languages and ethnicities. By the 1960s, the muralist tradition was in decline, but now murals are on their way back. Sarah Burke, with our partners at The Economist, has more for Mexico City.
7,500 new works have been commissioned by Iztapalapa, which is an area of Mexico City that's densely populated and very insecure. And since 2018, they've commissioned all these murals. And the aim is not purely aesthetic. I mean, they're very beautiful, bold colours, big shapes and pictures and faces of people. But the idea is that officials in Iztapalapa want to make this a safer place for residents to live. They have slogans saying no to violence or girls and boys are equal. And the ones of women's faces are particularly striking. You know, they're very large portraits and it gives them a sort of presence in the public space. So, for example, there's Lupita Bautista. She's a world champion boxer. Part of the reason there are so many women is that this whole project grew out of a push to improve the lot for women in this area of what is still a very male-dominated country. Things like the killing of women remain tragically high still. So part of the idea is just to make women more visible in the public space. There's some evidence that since this project started, that some crimes have fallen, such as those involving firearms. That could be for many reasons. The council has also put more lighting in and all the rest of it. But it's definitely true that the murals are popular and make people in the neighborhood feel better about where they come from. Lots of people said they were very proud of this art that's basically on their streets everywhere. And they hope that soon other people might come to see Iztapalapa in the same way that residents are now starting to do so.
That was Sarah Burke with our partners at The Economist. She told her story about the comeback of Mexican murals on The Economist's podcast, The Intelligence. The Grammys have a diversity problem. The music awards skew heavily white and male. Big-name stars like Drake, The Weeknd, Nicki Minaj, and Kanye West have all slammed the awards for overlooking artists of color. But there are some signs of progress this year in a category that usually doesn't get a lot of attention. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
The Children's Music Award. It's not the buzziest category. You're not going to see a Taylor-Kanye showdown or a slap, probably. But in late 2020, children's music generated a lot of headlines. In the year of the George Floyd protests, Breonna Taylor, the Black Lives Matter movement, all of the nominees in this category were white. Three of the five nominees dropped out in solidarity with musicians of color. After that whole mess, the Recording Academy made some changes, like getting rid of the secret committees that determine the final nominee list. This year, all of the nominees in children's music are artists of color, like Lucky Diaz for his album Crayon Kids. He totally wasn't expecting it. Diaz said he didn't even look at his phone the morning the nominations were announced. But then when he finally did check it, oh man.
It's craziness. My iPhone's blowing up and my watch. But yeah, I was very surprised.
Diaz already has two Latin Grammys, but he's never been nominated for a standard Grammy. He says he's been ignored.
I consider what I do to be very quintessentially American because I'm a Mexican-American, a first-generation Mexican-American. The music that I do is multilingual. It's Spanish, it's English, it's Spanglish, it's nonsense. We have albums that are entitled Fantástico or Buenos Días, right? And you know, when someone sees something like that, it's like, oh, well, it's just Latin, right? And it's not that, because the true American story is being from another place and reinventing yourself.
Sábado. Diaz says he's thrilled to get the recognition this year and happy for the other musicians, but he has some mixed feelings, and he even feels weird talking about them.
You know, and it's hard as a brown person to say anything other than, wow, this is amazing, because it is. But we've been doing this 13 years, right? And this would be our first general Grammy nomination, you know? Like, there's a problem.
Usually the criticism you hear about the Grammys being racist concerns the major categories. Album of the year, rap song of the year. Drake basically said it all when he accepted a Grammy in 2019 for Best Rap Song. God's plan!
This is a business where sometimes, you know, it's up to a bunch of people that might not understand, you know, what a mixed race kid from Canada has to say, or a fly Spanish girl from New York, or anybody else, or a brother from Houston right there, my brother Travis. But you don't need this right here. I promise you. You already won.
Aaron Nigel Smith is a children's music nominee this year for All One Tribe. Nigel Smith says if diversity is important anywhere, it's in children's music.
Children are so important because they are like sponges and they are so receptive to the messages that we're sending out through the music. And they're also the future leaders of the world, you know. And if we can encourage them to live lives that, you know, see everyone and respect everyone, then I think they'll be at the forefront of creating that world that we want to see. It's time to break down all the walls that we built so high.
For the world, I'm Sarah Bernbaum. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here Monday.